acknowledgements. The original author of this abstract is Leah Sage, who is no longer with TechCut and was unable to give this presentation, so I am replacing her. I'd also like to acknowledge the co-authors, Rola, Amo, and Mona, on the paper, as well as our Egyptian partner NGOs at the regional level, the local NGOs, and of course the communities in which the program took place, and finally UNICEF for their generous support. I'm not sure about the background of this audience, so I'll give you just a real brief blurb about the FGM in Egypt. Notice that I'm using the term FGM, female genital mutilation, and not FGC, cutting, which is the more typically used term in Egypt. FGM is the term that tends to be preferred, so I will use that throughout. Prevalence in Egypt has been at 97% since the 1995 DHS, as well as the 2000 and the 2003 interim. However, since prevalence, you're looking at women, married women, 15 and upward, that means that recent trends are not being captured yet. They have done some studies in the most recent DHS where they were looking at young married women and their intention to circumcise their daughters, and you do start seeing some minor changes there, but it is quite high. In Egypt, the type of FGM that's done is typically type 1 and 2, which are on the less severe end of the spectrum. And despite, or more likely because of, national legislation against the practice, they're seeing a trend of medicalization and decreasing age at which they're doing the cutting. Medicalization meaning their parents are taking the daughters to physicians to have, because there have been national campaigns about the dangers of FGM, so they're instead taking them to the doctor so the doctors can do them properly. And you're also seeing a decrease at the age in which they do it. Typically in Egypt, it really depends on the community, but 9 to 12 is sort of considered the age that most girls are circumcised, and you're seeing it going all the way down to a week old. The reasons that individuals and community members cite vary. Typically, religion is at the top of the list. It's a cultural practice. You have both Christian and Muslim communities that do the cutting, not because it's necessarily practice per religion, but because that's just part of the culture. Cleanliness is a big issue, and health, and one of the other main reasons is prevention of promiscuity. If the woman is uncut, then she is likely to commit adultery when she's married, etc. She's a bad girl, and viewed that way. Setha started doing work with FGM programs in 1998 using a positive deviancy approach, which actually came out of the nutrition sector, where you work and look at, identify individuals who are going against the norm. So looking at individuals who are deviating from the cultural norms, in this case, either being circumcised, circumcising a child, or speaking out against it, etc. And looking at these individuals and finding out what motivated them to be different from a norm, especially in a population where 97% is circumcised, being that 1 to 3% that isn't, is really quite different. And it's looking at how these individuals were convinced to be otherwise, and then using those theories and reasons to try to come up with strategies to approaches in which to try to disseminate messages against the practice. And that actually worked quite well at a very simple level, and it worked very well in some of the Egyptian communities that Setha was working at to just start breaking the silence about FGM. FGM was a very taboo subject in Egypt at the time. You just didn't talk about it, and getting people to start talking about why they didn't or why they weren't just really started the conversation going. It was very important. In 2002, we decided to try to formalize the approach a little bit more by developing just more structured program design, different phases to the program, some training materials for the partners, monitoring evaluation materials, and also incorporating more social mobilization approaches. It's one thing to look at individuals and talk to individuals one-on-one, but it really, you don't really get very far in a 97% prevalence community by having the one or two person make changes. You really do have to start looking at changing cultural norms. In 2003 and 2004, we then took this formalized plan and tried to scale up a little bit in communities by expanding into using regional NGO partners. Until that point, SEPA had been working very directly with the implementers at the community level. So now we sort of stepped back and worked with regional partners, trained them, who could then train the very local NGOs in an effort to reach a broader audience. And that takes us to the program that I'll actually talk a little bit more about today. A lot of the lessons that we learned throughout those early 6 years were really incorporated into this final project. So the program continued using private obedience as change agents from the community. We added the community mobilization and outreach where teams, called FGM team teams, which hold all sorts of events, everything from small groups that were just with men, small groups just with women, to really large events where they had guest speakers, all sorts of outreach activities to try to get the messages out of the community. And all of these activities were based on what the team members who were from the local community had decided would be the best approaches to use in that specific community. Then the third phase is identifying girls at risk, as I mentioned earlier. That was approximately 9 to 12, but depending on the community, that would range. The age might go as low as 7 and up higher. And the idea was to identify who the girls were. They did community mapping exercises, and then they did very regular home visits and tracking and monitoring. And in these home visits, they usually determined whether, you know, they talked to the parents and the girl about cutting and whether, you know, what were their thinking and how had some of the community events influenced their thinking. And at the point that they made a decision, be it for cutting or against cutting, they were placed on a surveillance list. And until that point, they kept having regular visits. And once they were on a surveillance list, they kept being visited. And the team members kept track of who had decided and in which way. This project took place in 4 governorates: Asut, Minya, Sohag, and Ena, and 40 communities. There are a number of objectives for the project. As I mentioned earlier, one of the issues was trying to bring the program to a wider audience, and the idea was to increase the number of very local community-based NGOs who were able to implement and who've been trained to implement the program through support of the regional-level partner NGOs. We were also aiming to increase the knowledge of community members about the dangers of FGM and to empower these same individuals to be advocates for eradicating the practice, specifically the positive deviants themselves. As well, increase the number of community leaders who were speaking out against FGM, and these included school teachers, physicians, religious leaders. And those latter two are actually extremely important now, and you'll hear me talk about them again as we found out. Couple more objectives. We're also trying to increase community mobilization activities, these events that I was talking about earlier. Of course, increase the number of girls who do not undergo cutting and, in the end, contribute to establishing FGM-free communities, which is, incidentally, now a real push in Egypt. In fact, even the First Lady is behind creating all these FGM-free communities. This happened a couple years ago, so it was a little before the bigger recent pushes. I've already mentioned some of these before. Basically, the program is sort of broken out into 3 phases, sort of program introduction and identification of positive deviance, and that's the first several of these, where we train the partner NGOs, select the local NGOs. Once local teams were formed, they did a situational analysis in the community to look at and identify who the community leaders would be, because that was really critical. And that was something that was moved up even more so than it had been before, because we realized that unless those community leaders were absolutely and emphatically on board with the types of activities, they were just not as credible with the community members. Once the team came together, we had a formalized workshop called an orientation workshop to the program and how you work with positive deviancy. And they identified positive deviants, who then all together made up the FGMAT team. So it included positive deviants, the local NGO, and oftentimes community leaders. So that's sort of phase one. Then phase two is the community mobilization or the community activity phase, and that also has commenced with a workshop that looked at analyzing and planning 6 months of program activities, and that usually started with taking some of the reasons why some of the positive deviants did not cut or did not have their daughters cut and translating those reasons into messages for the community. And I've mentioned some of those before. I'd be happy to speak more about them later if you're interested. So as I said, the community awareness activities included things like speakers, having a guest speaker come in, having a religious leader who preached against the practice come in, having a medical person talk about the harms of having circumcision done on girls and why not having it done is not harmful to the girls. They coordinated smaller meetings for just men or just women in which individuals were able to share their personal concerns better, and then some of the bigger events allowed for public outreach and supporting public dialogue about these sensitive issues. The third phase was the Girls at Risk phase. It also started with a workshop to talk through how the activities would go, and as I said earlier, the team would go door-to-door. They would go to all the houses that had daughters that were at risk of being cut or younger sisters and meet regularly every few weeks and start tracking them. We noticed over time that in order to keep track of all this information, the local NGOs really needed some extra training with monitoring evaluation tools that we had provided them. So that was ongoing. So all the information that came out of the program was really the local team keeping track of the members in their community, keeping track of the number of events they had, the types of events, etc., with the idea that they could actually learn from that information, self-evident, but has been proven to be quite helpful. A lot of the focus group discussions and interviews that they've done have helped allow us to make assumptions or avoid making certain assumptions about what kinds of interventions were working and which ones were not. In the last eight new communities, in the 6 months that the community mobilization activities took place, over almost 380 events took place and over 15,000 individuals were reached. I'll just run through a list of a few program achievements. A more formalized package for the program was completed, and with tools that the partners could use, some manuals on how to run the program. I think one of the biggest and most important outcomes has been that FGM has become a huge topic of conversation in these communities, and that shouldn't be underestimated. In a place where you just don't speak about those things and that topic is taboo, having public conversations, discussions in the communities, at meetings, between men and women is absolutely critical, as well as in the family. Before the activities, FGM was routine. The mother typically made the decision and or the grandmother. The father was rarely consulted. He was usually informed that it was going on. And there are some changes with regard to that as a result of the program. Obviously, increased awareness about the harmful effects. A recognition that circumcision doesn't regulate behavior. And what I mean by that is uncircumcised women were perceived unclean at best, sexually perverse at worst, and I think through people coming out and saying, I'm not cut, I'm married, I'm a mother, I'm a good person, people could really come out and see, you know, that circumcision does not go along with the type of behavior, it really is separate, which was also quite important. And more importantly, individuals through this program were encouraged to start questioning sociocultural practices that had sort of been taken for granted. And people started thinking for themselves, speaking up about challenging the social norms in a public venue, which is important, had debates. And as a result, more and more individuals were willing to publicly declare that they themselves were not intent on circumcising their daughters or wanting to be circumcised, as in the case of a lot of the young women. Engagement of the community leaders, including very active engagement as part of the team, was another important achievement. Introduction of rights-based gender equity. The youth especially became more aware about their rights because that was a lot of what the conversation was about, that a girl had the same right to not be cut. And what also came up, and I think some of this might have to do with the fact that we were doing some other activities around non-formal education for young people in some of the communities, but sensitivity about youth needs and that they actually had rights as individuals rather than none at all, which was difficult. Some favorable shifts in gender relations. As I mentioned earlier, the fathers used to not be involved. Lots of incidences where fathers were stepping in and saying, no, my daughter should not be cut, or disagreeing and fighting back with their mothers who were trying to insist that their daughters be circumcised, since it was oftentimes the grandmothers that were trying to perpetuate this. And importantly, as I mentioned, once a family made a decision, be it one way or the other, to circumcise or not circumcise, they were put on a surveillance list. Of the families that were on the surveillance list, 88% at the time that the project ended had actually made a decision about not circumcising their daughters, which is just phenomenal when you think about it. Now, I will have to say that might be slightly skewed because there were quite a few who hadn't made a decision one way or the other, but the important thing is that the dialogue is ongoing for those individuals and that there are changes and attitudes going on in the communities. 58 girls were circumcised during that period in relation to the 1187 families, by the way. Some challenges. Some of the Islamic religious leaders had a very public resistance to the program, especially because it was an international NGO, and part of the process of using the local community members helped to persuade that. However, it does make for an unwelcome environment when you're trying to do public awareness campaigns and activities. The roles of physicians was actually becoming a problem for us. Because even if they were against FGM, but not vehemently against, or kind of said, well, but in these circumstances, maybe it is necessary, they actually were not helpful to the program. And in fact, became a bit of an obstacle. So what we did is we worked very closely with physicians and religious leaders at the very beginning to orient them and to make them very emphatic supporters, and that made a huge difference. Problems with M&E reports, I already mentioned some of these other ones. The at-risk girls, to really consider them safe, you really have to have them married off without being circumcised, and that is many years and a lot of time, and of course, funding limitations. Finally, just I have one more minute, I think, a couple lessons learned that I wanted to highlight. Some of these are obvious. But to change social norms, you really do have to work both at the individual and at the community level, and that was very evident from our earlier work. The differences between and within the communities had to be clear so that the approaches used could be appropriate. Young people were very helpful. As I said, the religious leaders and physicians could become our biggest allies, but only if we channeled them appropriately. And it's really important to understand that women were actually the ones perpetuating this practice and dealing with that, but also not forget, and they were actually 80% of the participants in the activities. But once we realized that, we actually started focusing on trying to bring the men in because they were just as important and can counteract some of this. Finally, I'll just leave you with a couple quotes, both by men in the community, that I think really show some changes in the attitudes.